Madam President, I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant-at-Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail, and the Sergeant will be instructed to bring in the absent members. Today's chaplain is Senator Kubley, and after the prayer, please remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I have to admit that Mike asked me to do this yesterday, but I forgot about it until Cal reminded me. So it'll be short. Shall we pray? Creator God, indwelling Spirit, we thank you for the gift that you have given of your Spirit that comes to each one of us. We ask that we be sensitive to the leading of that Spirit as we deliberate the task before us today. Be with each of us as we not only seek to extrapolate our own understanding of what is being offered, but as we sometimes struggle to understand what others are offering as well. Keep us mindful of the fact that you are the creator of each and every one of us, making us members of the same family in you. In your strong name, amen.
Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Bach, Benson, Berglund, Bonhoff, Brown, Carlson, Chamberlain, Cohen, Dames, Daly, DeKreif, Dibble, Fishbach, Gazelka, Gerlach, Gimsey, Goodwin, Hall, Han, Harrington, Higgins, Hoffman, Howe, Ingebertson, Jungbauer, Kielesch, Koch, Cruz, Kubley, Langseth, Latz, Lilly, Limmer, Lori, Magnus, Marty, McGuire, Metzen, Michelle, Miller, Nelson, Newman, Nino, Olson, Ortman, Pappas, Perry, Peterson, Pogemiller, Reinert, Rest, Rose, Roebling, Rosen, Saxog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Sparks, Thompson, Tomasoni, Torres, Ray, Vandeveer, Wieger, Wolf.
Quorum is present. Moving to the third order of business is messages from the House. The Secretary will read the message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following House files herewith transmitted. House file numbers 632 and 1426. Elbin A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There's no Senate action necessary on that message. Moving to the fourth order of business, first reading of House bills. They are printed on today's agenda. First reading. Moving to the fifth order of business, reports of committees, Senator Koch.
Madam President, I move that the report of the committee pertaining to appointments be laid on the table.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the eighth order of business, first reading, introduction of first reading of Senate bills. They are printed on today's Senate bill introduction, and they will be referred as indicated. First reading. Moving to the ninth order of business, motions and resolutions. There are two authors' motions printed on today's agenda. Those will be taken as one motion. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen, I believe you have a motion.
I do. Thank you, Madam President. I move that Senate File 435 be withdrawn from the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans and given a second reading and placed on general orders.
Explanation to that motion, Senator Rosen.
This is a bill that had some rulemaking provisions in it that were taken out, and so it is not necessary that it go to the State Government Committee.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Reverting to the sixth order of business, we will give Senate File 435 its second reading. Second reading. Remaining under motions and resolutions, Senator Koch.
Madam President, I move that we take up the Senate calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion does prevail. We will be taking up the Senate calendar. Printed today, there are, I believe there's 10 bills that we will be voting on. Begin with number one, Senate File 768. The Secretary will give Senate File 768 its third reading. Secretary will give Senate File number 768 its third reading.
Senate File number 768, a bill for an act relating to education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 768. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 36 ayes and 25 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give Senate File 799 its third reading.
Senate File number 799, a bill for an act relating to higher education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 799. Oh, just a moment. Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 799. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 60 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving on, the secretary will give Senate File 1208, its third reading.
Senate File Number 1208, a bill for an act relating to commerce, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1208. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 60 ayes and one nay, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on calendar, the secretary will give Senate File 946 its third reading.
Senate File Number 946, a bill for an act relating to education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 946. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 36 ayes and 25 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on calendar, House, a secretary will give House File 1092 its third reading.
House File Number 1092, a bill for an act relating to education, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 1092. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 61 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give Senate File 1280 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1280, a bill for an act relating to employment, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1280. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 61 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give House File 447 its third reading.
House File Number 447, a bill for an act relating to vulnerable adults, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 447. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 61 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give Senate File 508 its third reading.
Senate File Number 508, a bill for an act relating to insurance, third reading.
Secretary will give... Take the roll on Senate File 508. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 61 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give Senate File 1045 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1045, a bill for an act relating to commerce, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1045. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 58 ayes and 3 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Secretary will give Senate File 247 its third reading.
Senate File Number 247, a bill for an act relating to insurance, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 247. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 34 ayes and 28 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. That completes the calendar. The rest that are printed here are to lie over. Senator Koch.
Madam President, pursuant to Rule 26, I designate the following bill be made a special order for immediate consideration. Senate File 943, number 108, on your general orders.
Senator Koch has designated a special order. We will begin with Senate File 943. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam President and members. Senate File 943 is the Game and Fish bill, omnibus bill. This, if you recall, last year was the bill that did not get past the governor's desk for a couple of reasons. Those particular problems have been taken out of this bill, but let me start out by saying it was an effort by both the Pawlenty administration and now the Dayton administration to put this bill together, and working with the DNR, it's been moving through the process, and it's something that that we needed done last year, but nevertheless, here we are. And it contains various game and fish laws, including the many recommended changes suggested by the administration and other changes added by committee members. And those changes were taken care of. I'm just going to go down through the bill real quickly, and if you have any questions, and I know there's at least one amendment that's going to be offered. Madam President, members, Section 1 deals with the compensation for elk damage. Those of you in Minnesota that may not know that we do have a fairly significant herd of elk in northwestern Minnesota or northeastern Minnesota, and that migrates back and forth from Canada, and it's growing, and we're running into some problems with elk doing damage similar to what it's in statute already with regards to wolf damage. It just basically puts something allows for damage to fencing of domesticated animals that are damaged by the elk. Section 2 is regards to state contract restrictions, aquacultures. Section 3, there's going to be some fish stuff here, containment facility definition. Just defining the containment facility and statute with regards to the VHS susceptible list. Section 4 is fish collector definition, adds a definition of fish collector to the purpose of aquaculture laws. Section 5, fish health inspection definition, broadens again the definition of fish health inspection. Section 6, it deals with fish health inspector definition as well. Section 7 is fish sample collecting, provides for fish collecting collector training and certification. And you're going to see some of this legislation because of the AIS issue that we're dealing with in the state of Minnesota, so there's going to be some changes with that. Section 8 also deals with the VHS fish inspection language. Section 9 is the sale of fish eggs and fry to the state, removes a cap on fish eggs and fry sales, and expands the program to allow barter. Section 10 also pertains to sucker eggs. Section 11 and 12, fish and wildlife planning. Some requirements there that the DNR had needed in this bill. Section 13, the harvest of bait from infected waters, again with regards to the AIS and VHS situation that we have in the state. Section 13 moves into the game section, defining sandhill crane, adding that to the definition under game birds. Section 15, small game definition of the gray wolf, adds gray wolf to the definition of small game. Section 16 deals with the undressing of bird definition, defining how you transport birds after they've been taken in the field from the field to home. Section 17 adds the Eurasian colored dove to the definition of unprotected birds. Section 18 clarifies that definition of wild animal, including dead wild animals. Section 19 with regards to the emergency deterrent material assistance allows for emergency deterrent materials. And again, the destruction of crops or pasture by elk damage. The section also increases the maximum amounts of assistance under that program. Section 20 is the walleye stamp revenue, specifies that all the revenue from the walleye stamp sales will be used for stocking walleyes purchased from the private sector, which is a new addition. Section 21 is regards to the minnow harvest and designated wildlife lakes. Section 22 is license refunds, allows the state of Minnesota within 90 days to be able to, for an applicant to be able to get a refund. Section 23 is regards to the mortality of big game by domesticated dogs, dealing with stiffer penalties. Section 24 is a gross misdemeanor penalty for hunting big game while under revocation. Section 25 is pictorial stamp purchases, removes the statutory $2 price to purchase a pictorial stamp and allows the DNR to set the price to cover the cost of producing and mailing the stamp. Members, you should just understand that's not a required stamp. That's a stamp that if you want to, if you happen to be a stamp collector, there's a lot of people that want to do that. Section 26, Game and Fish License Transfer, allows the Game and Fish License Transfer to a person with a severe disability or a critical illness who is participating in a special program sponsored by a nonprofit. A real nice thing to do here for those that have severe disabilities or critical illnesses. Section 27 deals with dealers, tanners, and taxidermists reports, allowing the DNR the option to approve report forms for dealers, tanners, and taxidermists instead of supplying the forms. Moving on, Madam President and members, Section 28 again deals with the elk licensure, actually the permit to hunt elk. Section 29 is a turkey license issuance, clarifies the authorities of the commissioner for issuing licenses to take wild turkeys. Section 30 is a new one. Members, I don't know if you realize this or not. I don't think too many do, that we're able to fish in our state parks without a license. This expands that opportunity to ice fishing in state parks. Section 31, non-resident fishing license surcharge, youth exemption. Section 32 is in regards to possessing an unlawful fish taken in Canada. Section 33, game bird transportation, clarifies that doves may be shipped or transported in accordance with federal law. Section 34, parent or guardian responsibility, it's a violation, making it a violation for a parent or guardian to knowingly permit a person under the age of 18 to hunt in violation of a specific license, permit, certification, or training requirements that are in our game laws and fish laws. Section 35 is the apprentice hunter validation requirements. Section 36, guns allowed while hunting by muzzle loader. Section 37 and 39, that's possession. Excuse me, I should back up to that and be a little more clear. Provides that a person with a valid muzzle loader license may only have a muzzle loader and a handgun in possession while they're hunting. Section 37 and 39 is medical evidence for disability permits. Those folks that have, for instance, will have surgery on their shoulder or something, they can get a special permit that can be filled out now by a nurse practitioner and certified by a physician assistant instead of a doctor. Makes it a little more easy. Section 38, the hunting hours, removes statutory hunting hours for certain species. Hunting hours will be established by the DNR by rule, giving them the authority. Section 40, possession of a firearm while hunting deer by archery, allows a person with a permit to carry handgun to have a handgun in possession while hunting deer by archery. However, they're prohibited from using the handgun for the purpose of taking deer. Section 41, bear bait station identification, allows a person to mark their bear baiting station with their DNR license number. DNR license number is the same number that you have in your hunting or your fishing license. Section 42, the taking elk causing damage or nuisance, again with regards to the damage. If you have some nuisance elk that simply just keep coming back, hence the word nuisance, their special permit to be able to take those. Section 43, gray wolf open season, allows for open season of gray wolves after they are delisted under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Section 44 is regards to shooting grouse near a motor vehicle. That prohibits the shooting of a grouse nor near a motorized vehicle unless the person is at least 10 feet from the vehicle. This prohibition would not apply to a person with a disability permit or permit to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle. So to understand that a little bit better, if you do have that permit, you can actually shoot from your vehicle at a grouse. Without that, you have to have at least 10 feet away. Section 45 pertains to waterfowl seasons. Pretty straightforward. Section 46 has to do with territorial fishing regulation adjustments. Section 47 and 48, clarifying the fishing contest provision. Section 49, fishing tournament invasive species. We talked about that in the invasive species bill some days ago, specifying that fishing tournament organizers shall take preventative measures to reduce the spread of invasive species. Section 50, sturgeon tag clarification, clarifies that only one tag application may be made per calendar year. Section 51, transporting and stocking fish, authorizes the commissioner to prohibit transportation of live fish by youth or aquarium purposes. Section 52, price of game fish, fry eggs, is dealt with in here. It's something the DNR wanted to deal with the also the private sector involved. Section 53, using aquatic life for bait, allows the commissioner to authorize the use of game fish eggs as bait. Section 54, the Bowser powers clarification, clarifies that the Board of Sword and clarifies that Bowser has the powers to implement delegated purposes related to the acceptance of grants or gifts. Section 55 something that I think is interesting with not only rural legislators but also metro legislators, because it seems like about every week or two we see a coyote report on the news down here in the metro area. They're starting to show up, so there's an overabundance of them. So we've dealt with that, allowing the township, all county and town boards to offer a bounty for taking coyotes. Section 56 is liability limits for walk-in programs. Section 57 is rulemaking things. Shallow lakes management. Section 58 is the shallow lakes management report, directing the DNR to complete a report on shallow lakes management by January 1, 2012, and then there's some other repealer languages dealing with fish and wildlife planning, deer areas, wild turkey licensing, and fishing contests without permits. And Madam President and members, that's basically the Game and Fish Bill in a nutshell, and I would stand for any questions.
Discussion of Senate File 943. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. I have the A-11 amendment.
Senator Gazelka offers the A-11 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Gazelka moves to amend Senate File 943 as follows. Page 14 after line 2, insert. This is the A-11 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. This language passed in the environmental budget bill. I'm looking for another vehicle just in case that gets held up. This was heard in committee. It has no fiscal impact. The DNR does not oppose it, but in a nutshell, what it does is it gives preferential treatment to service members that have received the Purple Heart or service-connected disability rated at 100%. They will give preferential treatment for lotteries, for selection of applicants for hunting and fishing licenses, permits, and special permits. This does not include moose, elk, and prairie chickens.
Further discussion on the A-11 amendment. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam President. And members, I have been in we have talked this over with Senator Gazelka. I would accept this as a friendly amendment, the A-11 amendment.
Discussion to the A-11 amendment. Senator Gazelka renews his motion that the A11 amendment be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 943. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. Will Senator Ingebrigtsen yield?
Senator Ingebrigtsen will yield. Senator Goodwin.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, there's nothing in here on Fish Lake, is there?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam President, I will ask for a point of clarification from Senator Goodwin on that question. No, there's not.
Further discussion on Senate File 943. Secretary will give Senate File 943 its third reading.
Senate File 943, a bill for an act relating to game and fish, third reading.
Final discussion on Senate File 943. Seeing none, the Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 943. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 62 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Senator Koch.
Madam President, I would move that we take up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, aye. No. The motion does prevail. Senator Koch.
I move that the Senate do now resolve itself into a committee of the whole for the purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail.
Members, on your desk in front of you, you have a list of the general orders for the day.
Thank you, Senator Koch. We will begin with Senate File 1285, number 44 on general orders. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File number 1285 be recommended to pass.
To that motion, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, this is a DHS policy bill that was brought to us fairly late in the session, but I will tell you that in the committee, we did have a pretty thorough vetting of the bill late in April. And the purpose of the bill is to make certain changes to the chemical and mental health statutes, summarized as follows. It will require an adult diagnostic assessment update be completed if diagnostic assessments have been completed within 3 years preceding admission for day treatment services, and that is a change from a law which currently reads within 180 days. It modifies the licensing moratorium related to child foster care by carving out an exception for new foster care licenses determined to be needed by the commissioner due to restructuring of state-operated services that limit the capacity of state-operated facilities. Next, it amends the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund section of the law, and these changes are due to a provision passed by the legislature instructing the department to develop a new chemical dependency rate methodology that is uniform statewide. The bill modifies the section of law authorizing medical assistance payments for intensive rehabilitation mental health services by requiring the commissioner to streamline the rate setting process of the assertive community treatment teams and intensive residential services. The new rate setting will eliminate the annual settle up process, which was cumbersome, and will set annual prospective rates based on the actual reported costs and utilization from the previous year. The bill will require that in a mental health crisis, a mobile crisis intervention team must be available to meet face-to-face with the person in a hospital emergency room. Currently, we only require an intervention team to be present in the health crisis, emergency, or community setting. The bill will add to the list of issues that must be evaluated by the crisis intervention team. If a crisis exists, the crisis assessment must also evaluate, as time permits, the recipient's preference as communicated verbally or in a health care directive treatment plan, crisis prevention plan, or wellness recovery plan. Finally, the bill amends the intensive rehabilitation health services to expand services to individuals ages 16 to 21, and this is a provision of the bill that was quite important to the department. I'd indicate there is no fiscal implication to the bill, as currently these folks are covered, and additionally, it affects very few individuals. With relation to the rehabilitation mental health services, the treatment team shall furnish and establish communications and collaboration with the family and significant other of the client and educate them about the mental illness, symptom management, and the family's role in treatment, unless the team knows of or has reason to suspect the client has suffered or faces a threat of suffering any physical or mental injury, abuse, neglect from a family member or significant other. A client of age 18 or older may orally agree or object to the disclosure and may prohibit or restrict disclosure to specific individuals. There are also modifications made to rehabilitation mental health services, provider contact requirements, and standards for providers, service standards, and rate setting. That, members and Madam President, is a summary of the DHS bill. Thank you much. Thank you very much.
Any further discussion on Senate File 1285? There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Newman that Senate File 1285 be recommended pass. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senate File 373, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move when the committee do arise that Senate File 373 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Oh, excuse me. Discussion, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I intended to be very brief. This bill reduces the statute of limitations, which is a default statute of limitations, so anything that's specifically in our statutes having a different statute of limitations would be 4 years instead of the current default, which is 6 years. Members, this basically affects contracts, trespass, personal property, fraud, trust actions, sureties, and damages. Members, 30-some other states have 1 to 3 year general statutes of limitations. Only 7 have a 6 year statute of limitations, and Minnesotans have asked us to look at this. Businesses from all over the state, including 58,000 of them, have asked us to make some reasonable reforms so they can manage their liability and we can have swift access to justice. It will help all Minnesotans. I hope you'll support this bill.
Any further discussion on Senate File 373? Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'd urge you to oppose this bill. The 6 year statute of limitations has been in law in Minnesota since 1841, and frankly, it's been working just fine for that period of time. There isn't any crisis in Minnesota, and there hasn't been, that would justify any need to reduce the statute of limitations. One of the arguments in favor of doing this is that it would reduce congestion in the courts or the need for court issues. The fact is, civil filings have been down 40% in the last 10 years in Minnesota, even without any of this statute of limitations reform. So there's no litigation abuse or no explosion of litigation in Minnesota that this needs to address. This is a very, very broad bill. It addresses a broad range of legal actions in Minnesota, including personal injury causes of action, and including domestic abuse or violence civil causes that arise out of those kinds of incidents. So victims of family violence, for example, that are going through a difficult divorce and just aren't ready to bring their claim legitimately arose out of their relationship. Sometimes it takes years before they're in an emotional position to be able to bring that claim. Shortening the statute of limitations to 4 years would have the impact there of cutting people out of their legal rights and remedies. Also, in other states, typically where they have a shorter statute of limitations period, they have what's called a discovery rule, which means it may be a 2 or 3 year statute of limitations after you discover that the injury occurred. But Minnesota, as a general matter, does not use the discovery rule except in some very particular situations. So the time period starts to run when the injury occurred, not necessarily when the person knows that they had a legitimate claim against a particular defendant. This is a significant impact because sometimes information takes years before it's available or becomes apparent to a person that they actually have a legal cause of action and that they know who caused whatever damages they're facing. So Minnesota is not out of bounds in its current laws, and what you really have here is the insurance industry and the big corporations that are looking for a way to reduce their exposure. But I will tell you that the insurance industry will not pass on any premium savings or any dollar savings that they get from this situation. The studies are pretty significant around the country and consistent that on the broad range of tort reform initiatives, including statute of limitations, that even in cases where there are cost savings to insurance companies, and typically there are not any, but where there are, those cost savings are not passed on to the premium payers. Businesses are not going to save any money on their premiums. Individuals are not going to save any money on their premiums. It's going to go directly into the pockets of the insurance industry. So, again, there's no great value to passing this tort reform. It will not benefit the consumers, the people that ultimately are paying the premiums, because they're not going to see any reduction in the premiums. There were no consumer advocates that were present to testify in favor of this bill. The advocates in favor of this bill that testified were the insurance industry only. Senator Ortman has passed around supporters of this, the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. If you take a look at the list, they're trying to reform certain aspects of the civil justice system, but take a look at who's on the list. It's all corporations, it's all employers, it's all companies, it's the chambers of commerce. You don't see, and as I'm looking through here, I don't see one consumer advocacy group here. I don't see one advocate for individuals who are injured, either in auto accidents or in employment cases or in industrial accidents or in toxic tort cases, or I don't see any advocates for injured people. And believe me, every one of your constituents is potentially an injured person. Could be today on their way home from work, could be tomorrow if they're at a park or on private property and someone negligently maintained the property and they got injured as a result. Or it could be when they're dealing with medical malpractice claims or all sorts of injuries that they might incur. So there really is no harm that needs to be addressed. This is one of those cases, one of those bills where it's searching for a solution, claiming that they're going to save money, and in fact, it's not going to save money for anyone except the insurance companies. There's no reason to pass this bill. I'd encourage you to vote no.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Actually, on the committee, I got to testify in favor of this bill as well, and I rise in favor of it. And let me tell you how these things work in real life. I am in favor of reducing the statute of limitations, because in real life, members, we are all, and your constituents all, could be sued. We are a very litigious state in Minnesota. And I'll just tell you one example of what happened to me. One day before the 6-year of statute of limitations on a case, I was sued. Now, why people do that one day before that statute of limitations expires is they hope that you and others around that case don't remember what went on. They hope you can't find witnesses. They hope that your memory is so foggy that they can somehow get a judgment against you. And we need to shorten that up. We need to shorten that up because it does injure people like you, and it has injured people like me in the past. And this is a good bill. Please vote in favor of it.
Further discussion on
Mr.
Senate
Chairman.
373. Senator Cohen.
Would move a call of the Senate, please.
Senator Cohen moves call of the Senate. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe you can put the Senate under call when we're in
general orders.
Just verify that.
I'm sorry. I was mistaken.
Thank you. Any further discussion on Senate File 373?
Mr. Chairman, I ask for a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Any further discussion on Senate File? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just a couple of quick comments. Just because something was done a certain way in 1840 doesn't mean that that's really a good idea for today. And the time it took to get to a lawyer, bring all the files, talk about the evidence, develop the evidence, was a very different thing than it is today, honestly. The evidence now in our very mobile society is much more difficult to maintain, and witnesses move. Once someone knows that they have a lawsuit, all we're asking is that they bring it and file it within 4 years to put folks on notice that there are legal issues related to the conduct. And this will help our businesses in Minnesota, absolutely true, because right now they have to insure against all potential liabilities. Those are costs of doing business in Minnesota that are getting in the way of new businesses coming here, businesses expanding here. The costs of litigation are enormous. And so actually the savings from this will get passed along to employees in terms of more salary and benefits for more employees. They might be able to grow and expand their business, passed along to consumers. So this is good for our entire economy. It's good for businesses. 58,000 employers. Think about how many employees that is. Their business will be more likely to succeed because we've taken some reasonable measures to reform a law that's outdated from 1840.
Further discussion, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman and members, not to belabor the point, but to clarify Senator Ortman's comment that all she's asking is that once people know about their claim, that they bring it within 4 years. But that is, in fact, not the language that's in the bill, because that's the discovery rule that we don't have in Minnesota. The 4 years would be from the date that the injury occurs, whether or not the person knows they have a claim against a particular defendant. And in some case, you know, in an auto accident, yeah, they know it right away if they're injured. But there are a lot of claims out there that they just don't know that they have an injury right away. It takes some time for them to figure it out and to find out that they actually have legal rights relating to it.
Any further discussion? There being no further discussion, Senator Kielash.
Yeah. Mr. President, what I don't get on this is a bill that allows businesses or gets allows businesses to have a shorter time frame for claims to be made against them. At the same time, it's not looking at the claims of individuals. I'll give an example in the case of the asbestos that has been in rampant throughout the state in construction and boilers, etc. It's taken years for people to realize that their exposure to those kinds of contaminants has caused them health problems. They need the time to know that if they find out that something they've been exposed to is causing health problems, that they can get an opportunity to go to court and justify the reason why they should be compensated by the business that exposed them to it. Now, what we're looking at here is we have another case where we're favoring business at the expense of all Minnesotans that have a claim to file here and have the time to be able to get it in front of them. In some cases, there's an awareness factor that doesn't always immediately happen, such as the case of asbestos. So I think this is another attempt to take away the rights of individual Minnesotans to find just cause and take their claims to court. And in a timely fashion, it is not something that is excessive. Like Senator Latz said, it's been on the books for 141 years. The numbers of claims are down 40%. I think this is a bill that is looking for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. The statute of limitations applies to defendants, whether they are individual defendants or corporate defendants. It applies across the board to every defendant. And oftentimes when we have cases for trespass, assault, battery, false imprisonment, we're talking about individuals. And oftentimes it could be a business suing a plaintiff, a business suing an individual as well. So this is very fair. It's across the board. Plaintiffs and defendants both can be individuals or corporations. This isn't business heavy, but it is business friendly.
There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Ortman that Senate File 373 be recommended to pass. Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, secretary will close the roll. Being there's 42 yeas and 20 nays, the motion prevails. The committee has before it number 57 on the general orders calendar, Senate file 149. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate file 149 be recommended to pass.
On that motion.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senate file 149 is further reform for our justice system. What it would provide, Mr. President and members, is that folks that file trade practices, consumer fraud, and false advertising claims actually be able to show that they've suffered some actual damages. So some actual out-of-pocket cost. And then it also allows that if the district court decides to certify a class action to move forward, that decision to certify the class be immediately appealable to our Court of Appeals for review to make sure that the certification is appropriate and make sure that parties do not have to go forward in a class action manner, which is very expensive and time-consuming, without there being further review available.
Further discussion on Senate File 149. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, would Senator Ortman yield?
Senator Ortman will yield.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, just to get this started, could you explain what the problem is and what's going on in Minnesota that would necessitate this?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. President, I knew somebody was going to ask me that question because I've heard it asked in all of our committees and I've heard it asked on this Senate floor. Senator Cohen, I believe we are policymakers in the state of Minnesota, that it's not necessarily a victim solution or problem answer that we should be looking at. I do think these are reasonable reforms and policies for our state. I have been a trial lawyer on both sides, plaintiff and defendant, and I have seen that there has been a real problem in this area. I have seen plaintiffs file lawsuits with no actual damages, and the courts spend a tremendous amount of time resolving those issues. It's very expensive for our system. It's very expensive for our litigants. I also have seen what happens when a class gets certified, Senator Cohen. Oftentimes a class gets certified and the defendants, because of the enormous cost of managing a lawsuit with a class in it, often will try and settle that case for nuisance value because it's way more expensive to litigate. That's not a good policy outcome for the state of Minnesota. We don't want to make these costs more expensive to resolve our issues. We want to minimize the costs of seeking and receiving justice in our courts. And that's what this bill is intended to accomplish.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I apologize for asking the question. I don't serve on the committee, so I haven't had the chance to listen to the explanation as to what the problem is, and I infer from your answer there really isn't a problem. So what concerns me when you discuss the need to, that we're policymakers is, and again, I have to make clear, I've never done work of this sort, so I don't presume to have anything personally at stake. But it concerns me when we, with such a broad stroke, eliminate many of the protections for consumers in Minnesota. Obviously, a class action lawsuit, as an example, is a means for a variety of people who've been harmed by some particular problem. You know, it could be food poisoning. It could be something with a product defect. But they're not able to engage a lawyer to solicit some type of or continue some type of action where the damages might be limited but significant. And the class action allows for a consolidation of interests to pursue it, arguably better for the not only the plaintiffs but the defense. Is it possible that we would find a situation where, depending on, again, the significance of the class, that you'd have a number of suits filed, so the defense would have to defend themselves over and over again? And if that hypothetical is not correct, then clearly what you're suggesting is we're looking for a way to eliminate consumers from the courtroom. And that's what concerns me, because what I have not heard from you is whether or not there are any concerns in Minnesota with these actions. I mean, are the courts overburdened with class action lawsuits? Are the courts just struggling to maintain what they can do with consumer types of lawsuits? We're going to hear a bill of yours, I think, next, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's on the calendar, yeah, relative to the increase in the limit for conciliation court, the jurisdictional limit. As you know, in the Finance Committee, I had a couple questions about that, but ultimately supported the bill. So on one hand, you're trying to expand the ability for consumers to get access to the courts in a somewhat simpler way, but on the other side, you're making an effort to take away significant consumer opportunities. And it just seems to me, absent some ability to delineate what the problem is, to quantify what the problem is, to indicate how this is burdensome to courts, to defendants, to companies, whoever it is, it seems to me that we should not walk into this with eyes shut, and we should be aware of what the problem is in Minnesota.
Further discussion on Senate File 149, Senator Latz.
I ask for a roll call vote.
Roll call is granted.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a really bad bill. This is a really bad bill. You know, reasonable minds can differ on the efficacy of a six-year versus a four-year statute of limitations. But this bill has a lot of problems with it. Number one, for those of you who are concerned about the integrity of the courts as a separate branch of government and their ability to set their own rules relating to litigation, this is a legislative encroachment into setting those court rules by defining when an appeal can be made during the litigation process. So for those of you who are lawyers and who care about the judicial independence and their ability to set their litigation rules, their court rules, this bill is a massive intrusion on that, because what it does is, under current judicial court rules, you can't appeal a class action determination by the district court judge while the case is pending. You have to wait until the case is over, when almost every issue can be appealed. There are very, very few issues in a litigation process that can be appealed on an interlocutory basis, which means that while the case is still pending in district court. This bill before you, by statute, would allow that appeal to take place as soon as the class action certification occurs, near the beginning of the case. In addition, it would stop the case in its tracks while that appeal is happening. So potentially for a year or for 2 years, while the appeal is going on through the State Court of Appeals to the State Supreme Court, potentially to the U.S. Supreme Court, nothing would be happening on the case, and the defendants would have bought at least another year or two of time to potentially continue doing what they have been doing that is a basis for the violation of law. But certainly it's a massive intrusion in the court's own ability to control their litigation. Secondly, the effect of this would be to eviscerate Minnesota's consumer protection laws. And I can't overstate this, members, because it would impose such an incredible burden on the ability of plaintiffs, and specifically, yes, their lawyers, to prove a case in the litigation process, that there wouldn't be any ability for them to bring the case in the first place. As a practical matter, lawyers will not be able to take on these broad class action consumer cases. Now, the consumer protection laws in Minnesota are specifically set up through Section 8.31, the Private Attorney General statute, which is basically the enabling statute for Chapter 325F and the other consumer protection statutes, to allow the lawyers to aggregate claims into a large lawsuit. Now, if you have a false advertising claim, let's say, for example, a retailer puts out a coupon or advertises something, and you get 25 cents off, but it's false, it's misleading, it's inaccurate, it's patently inaccurate, it violates the law. Let's say there's no doubt that it violates the law. What individual consumer is going to be willing to pay a lawyer to go after a 25-cent loss? No one will. But if a lawyer is able to aggregate claims among a vast class of consumers, that money adds up. That money adds up to the point where it's financially advantageous for a corporation to make that misleading statement or ad, knowing that most consumers aren't going to care enough or have the financial resources to bring a legal claim, and without the ability to aggregate these claims, the corporations would not be held accountable. So the consumer protection laws, which have had broad bipartisan support for decades in Minnesota, are important to protect the rights of all of us consumers. The effect of the bill before you would be to eliminate the ability of consumers and business, who are also victims in these kinds of cases, to hold companies accountable for fraudulent and deceptive acts. In addition, because of the change that's included in this bill relating to the proof required at the front end of a lawsuit, it would have the potential for massively increasing the burden on the courts. Because as a practical matter, you would the lawyers and the lead plaintiffs bringing the claims would have to have individual identifiable economic loss for each claimant or each member of the class in the lawsuit in district court before they could proceed with a case. Or they will be out of the case will be thrown out on summary judgment. The case will be thrown out without that level of proof. The cost and the burden and frankly just the sheer capacity of any lawyer bringing a claim under this law to be able to gather that information, even to find the individual consumers that have been harmed to the point of 25 cents or 50 cents on a misleading ad for oranges at a supermarket, for example. There's no way that they could find the information to identify a specific victim of that consumer fraud and have the proof that they were in fact victimized. So every one of your constituents that is misled by this, they're never going to have a remedy. They're never going to have a remedy. And the companies that do this, and sometimes they do it intentionally, sometimes they don't, but they're still subject to the consumer protection statutes, and they're held to certain standards, and certainly when they are fraudulently doing this, they're held to an even more important standard. They will know that they can get away with it if this bill passes. This would be a radical change in Minnesota consumer protection laws. And so for any of you who are concerned about holding companies accountable for their advertising and for their marketing, you need to oppose this bill. So I urge your no vote on it.
Further discussion on Senate File 149.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members, I also rise to share with you why I will be voting against this bill. My district is affected by the airport noise, and originally there was arrangements made by the airport to do noise abatement for a large section of South Minneapolis. Later, the MAC decided to take a portion of it out of their plan. And the city of Minneapolis brought a class action lawsuit on behalf of all those homeowners, and they won. And so many of those homeowners are now getting, you know, additional storm windows, etc., to make their homes more noise proof. That class action lawsuit by the city of Minneapolis wouldn't have been able to take place if this law had been passed at that time. And yet we all know that airport noise does affect home values. So I just think this is a bill that we need to be careful, and if there are certain kinds of abuses going on, then perhaps we should have a bill with a narrower focus. This bill has a very broad focus, and I think it will affect people who should be able to bring class action lawsuits, either on behalf of themselves and others, or others on behalf of a large group. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 149. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Lyatz offered some significant concerns about the bill, but I just want to make sure to follow up on what Senator Berglund said, that we understand that some of these class action lawsuits are not minimal kinds of suits. A common, as an example, a very significant type of class action suit have been the claims involving asbestos and the effects of asbestos on the workers who unknowingly found themselves in situations where they had huge health concerns as a direct consequence of being exposed to asbestos in a way that was not known as to what the harm might be. They went to work. They were earning a living for their families, making what they thought was a good salary, and then found themselves at some point with a ruined life and potentially fatal health complications. So to take that type of ability away from a worker to join in a class action suit to pursue a claim that, again, is basically life-threatening is something that simply is unfair and egregious, particularly since we do not have from the author some type of quantification as to what the problem is or why we're doing this. Additionally, Senator Lyatz indicated his concern with the language that puts a requirement on the court to stop discovery. I thought, when I read my paper on November 3rd, 2010, whatever day it was after the election, I thought we had elected a conservative legislature. That's what I've been told. That's what I've been told all session. Apparently not. Apparently we elected a really radical legislature, because when you start combining the legislative branch with the judicial branch, that is clearly contrary to what we have done in this state, what has been done in this country. We have not interfered with the discovery process. In the time I've been in the Senate, I can only think of one other example where we dealt with the rules of the court, and that was an effort by county attorneys to secure a different order of final argument in criminal matters. They asked for the opportunity to argue last, not first, in summation to the jury. The legislature passed a bill saying that that would be the case, but the Supreme Court made the request that this was highly irregular and understood the sense of the legislature, but said, we will draft a rule that comports with what you're suggesting, but let us draft the rule. This language does not leave any room for something of that sort. It says that absolutely discovery proceedings must be stayed. This would be a first, as best I know. This is not a conservative act. This is a truly radical act relative to the separation of powers.
Senator Artman.
Thank you. The hyperbole in here is pretty enormous. I got to say, eviscerate. To deprive of vital content or force, to take out the entrails or disembowel. That's not what's happening in this bill. This is a common sense bill. It just says that if you want to file a lawsuit for false advertising, unlawful trade practices, or prevention of consumer fraud, that you actually have been damaged before you can maintain that lawsuit. That would not affect any lawsuit that was brought against the city of Minneapolis and the airport for noise. It has absolutely no application whatsoever. What we're talking about with respect to the interlocutory appeal is just asking our courts, when there is so much at stake, that they stop and pause and look to make sure that the district court's certification, which essentially multiplies the size of the lawsuit, we ask that the Court of Appeals look at that decision. We haven't engaged in the discovery process, Senator Cohen. It has nothing to do with the discovery rules or process. It absolutely does not determine what the outcome should be. It just asks them to look and authorize that interlocutory appeal. And then one of the speakers, Mr. President, mentioned, in fact, their concern that a lawyer would not want to bring a claim for 25 cents. I absolutely disagree with that, and I just want to give you a couple of examples of where class actions have gotten completely out of control. The Blockbuster lawsuit, if you remember, the late fees, actual plaintiffs in the class action were awarded a $1 coupon for the results of the class action. Guess how much the lawyers got? $9.25 million. I think those lawyers had a pretty good incentive to help those people that paid a late fee on a video rental bring a lawsuit, turn it into a class action, and get $9.25 million. There's plenty of incentive to file a class action for 25 cents. Same deal in an engine horsepower marketing case. The plaintiffs got $35. The lawyers got $37.66 million plus interest. There's a Minnesota case, In re Arcadia, related to stock prices. The injured got a $500 coupon. The lawyers got more than $1 million right here in Hennepin County, Senator Cohen. There's a list. It just goes on and on. The attorneys get millions of dollars for finding folks that have been damaged by false advertising or in a class action. They're very motivated to bring these lawsuits. There's no reason why they shouldn't bring these lawsuits. We want them to. We just want to make sure that once that class is certified by the court, there's a reason for the certification, and that we don't have the certification being the very reason for the settlement. We want defendants, if they want to seek further review and obtain justice, not to have to do it with the threat of enormous costs of litigation. That's a very sensible reform.
We're awful close to a vote here, Senator Latz.
Senator Perry, I am, Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased that we are, and I'm also pleased that we have a history of fully discussing issues before the Senate body so that all members are fully informed when they get to vote. Members, Senator Ortman made a couple of comments that I think we need to elucidate here on the floor. I think she was right about the definition of eviscerate. And I reiterate the term, because this bill would disembowel, as a practical matter, it would disembowel the consumer protection laws in Minnesota. Because as it is right now, individuals who seek to recover a settlement in a class action have to show actual proof that they were damaged under the law in order to participate in the settlement. The difference is that in the bill before you, they would have to show that actual proof, and the people bringing the claim, the lawyers on behalf of the consumers bringing the claim, would have to show that actual proof for all of the consumers that they hope would participate in the recovery at the initial stages of the lawsuit. So they'd have to go out and they'd have to solicit from all 5.5 million Minnesotans who might have been exposed to this fraudulent ad and get enough of them to come in and to make their claim and to show the ad and to show the receipt and then submit all of that to the court just to survive summary judgment. Class actions are a tool for judicial efficiency, members. It's a way of bringing suits on behalf of a broad swath of injured parties without burdening the courts with individual lawsuits for 100,000 people. And if you have to have all that information ahead of time when you bring the lawsuit, it's going to be an immense financial burden on the claimants bringing the lawsuit. And what Senator Ortman didn't tell you was that those cases where the lawyers made a lot of money, the money that they made was a fraction, a percentage of the damages that were deemed to be provable and caused the defendant corporations to settle the case. So if they made $1 million on it, damages would have been multiple millions of dollars, meaning consumers were injured to the tune of and the corporations illegally benefited in the amount of millions of dollars. That's how the lawyers' fees are calculated. So, yes, maybe a $1 coupon, all that points out is that the individual consumer would never have found it financially advantageous to bring the claim alone. But the law is set up to encourage attorneys to take a look at these situations, to find these fraudulent situations, to be able to bring the claims. Unless we want to add $100 million to the Attorney General's budget so they can be the ones bringing these claims, we need to leave in place the rules that facilitate private lawyers to bring these claims on behalf of the consumers.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senator Ortman pointed out that there's been a lot of really heated rhetoric here. Boy, has there ever. The fact is that this proposed legislation put forth by Senator Ortman in no way restricts or impedes the ability of a legitimate class action suit to go forward. So let's be clear. If you have a legitimate class with damages that is properly certified, class actions will go forward just fine. The opponents of this legislation would seem to want members to believe that this will result in an inability to enforce consumer protection laws. I would point out that there are a myriad of state and federal consumer protection laws, and there are agencies in place to enforce them, and there are attorneys employed by the state to bring lawsuits when necessary. So it's fine to oppose this legislation if you want to. But to make the argument that this will, whatever grandiose adjective you choose to use, ultimately completely eliminate the consumer protection laws in this state, in this nation, is frankly over the top and silly.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. President, I just want to point out that not every potential plaintiff in a class has to show the damages before the class is certified. That's just not correct. In the point of certification, the court will look to determine whether there are a sufficient number of plaintiffs to certify a class, and then those plaintiffs will have to establish the damages. But in order to obtain the relief, then they would have to show the damages. So the timing is very important. We're asking the court to look at the certification of the class and nothing more.
Any further discussion? Senator Cohen.
Has there been a request for roll call?
Yes, there has. There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Ortman that Senate File 149 be recommended to pass. Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, Secretary will close the roll. Being there's 36 ayes and 26 nays, the motion prevails. The committee has before it number 86 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 506. Senator Ortman.
Mr. President, I do apologize. I thought there were a couple other bills before this third one. Members, I'm hoping that members
Senator,
will support. Oh, I'm sorry. My motion
move.
First. You caught me off guard, Mr. President. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File Number 506 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. This bill would change the conciliation court jurisdictional amounts to $20,000. It would allow Minnesotans with a small claim up to $20,000 to bring that claim in conciliation court instead of requiring, as we do now, those claims to go to the district court. This is an access to justice issue, members, and it will also provide some court savings.
Further discussion on Senate File 506, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair and members, I do support this legislation. I think it's an overdue approach to try to pull some of the relatively small lawsuits out of the main civil filing system for district courts and into conciliation court. Separate and aside from the issue of not enough resources being available for conciliation courts because there's a lot of delay, but this will help the consumers and individuals be able to bring their claims. So I support this bill. I do have one fairly narrowly tailored amendment that I'd like to offer, and that's the A2 amendment.
Senator Latz offers the A2 amendment. Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Latz moves to amend Senate File 506 as follows. Page 1, line 10, delete. This is the A2 amendment.
On the amendment, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. No doubt you have all seen over the last year articles in the Star Tribune, a series relating to issues involving debt collectors, particularly purchased debt, not a debt that is sought to be collected by the original provider of the loan, for example, or credit card company or bank, but when they have sold that debt off. Sometimes that debt gets sold and resold four, five, six, seven times. And there have been a variety of abuses or concerns documented in the Star Tribune series. One of those has been the aggregation of just large numbers of claims relating to that with motions for default judgment and so on. And so what the amendment before you would do, it would carve out from the increased dollar amount limits in conciliation court purchased debt and would leave it at current law. I will tell you that there are ongoing negotiations among all of the interested parties relating to addressing the variety of issues that have been raised in the debt collection industry. There has not yet been an agreement as to how to address it, but this narrowly tailored amendment would just leave in effect current law with regard to the dollar amounts that can be addressed in conciliation court on these kinds of purchased debt collection activities. So I'd ask for your support.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. I consider this to be a friendly amendment.
Any further discussion? On the Latz A2 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment prevails. Further discussion on Senate File 506. There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Ortman that Senate File 506 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The committee has before it now number 82 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 11. House File 1105, Senator Jungbar.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, House File 1105 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the, as I described in our caucus, the bill that keeps on giving. It's a bill I passed in 2008, DPS clarifying the difference between commercial vehicles and passenger vehicles when it comes to the use of a Y plate. Things got confused and we had pickup trucks members that could have a very high gross vehicle weight rating. And so folks were using, especially in my district, I found they were using Y plates, perhaps pulling their horse trailers and then getting stuck in commercial vehicle enforcement safety inspections. So I'd get these nasty calls, and I would ask my constituents, do you have a Y plate on your truck? And they said yes. And I said, well, that is a commercial plate, and so you are subject to commercial inspection. So DPS has worked hard over the years and through their new computer system so that people could designate the vehicle as being used for commercial purposes or being used for non-commercial purposes. This clarifies that. changes the plate structure a little bit so that we have only commercial vehicles using that Y plate with the commercial designation. I ask for your support.
Any further discussion on House File 1105? There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Jungbauer that House File 1105 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The committee has before it number 85 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1009, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1009 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 1009 is a bill that was brought to us by the Secretary of State, and it would modify the procedures for filing a vacancy in nomination of only nonpartisan offices. If a person wishes to be on a ballot, when there's an unexpected opening on the general election ballot, this bill is focused on between the times of a primary election and a general election when there's a vacancy that occurs. Most often the vacancy would be caused by the death or, in this bill, a catastrophic illness that the candidate would be forced to withdraw. It would repeal provisions that come into play when a vacancy and nomination occurs. When a person is wishing to be on the ballot, would file an affidavit of candidacy instead of going around and searching for petitions. It would simply be a certificate of candidacy, and it would make it a much more streamlined system, as well as in the event of a vacancy in between primary and general election, speed, of course, is of essence. The bill would also do away in the event of a death, the candidate's name would also remain in the ballot if there was no other candidate, and then be treated simply as a vacancy in office at the end of it. This bill really originated from the event where 24 candidates for judiciary position in the 10th Judicial District occurred, and then when those candidates were seemingly trapped on the ballot, they could not get off the ballot because the withdrawal period was too small, so it was extended a little bit. I'll stand for questions.
Any further discussion? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A2 amendment.
Senator Rest offers the A2 amendment. Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Rest moves to amend Senate File 1009 as follows. Page 2 after line 15, insert. This is the A2 amendment.
On the amendment, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A2 amendment is styled after Senate File 156, which passed this body in early April. It is a very simple change to the canvassing process, which would allow the canvassing boards to meet either following a primary election, to meet either on the following Thursday or Friday. It was agreed to by all the parties, including the Secretary of State and the supported by the cities and counties. And it's a very simple change, but it gives the local governments some opportunity for flexibility. It passed the Senate 64-0. It's stymied in the House, so this will, by allowing this to go on, this bill, it will keep it alive. I've spoken with both Chair Vanderveer and Senator Limmer, and they have no objection.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, you're absolutely correct. Members, you may remember this amendment. We had it in bill form, and I believe it was on April 7th. All those voting voted for the provision, 64-0, and I consider this a friendly amendment.
Any further discussion? On the Rest A2 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment prevails. Any further discussion on Senate File 1009? There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Limmer that Senate File 1009 be recommended to pass. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The committee has before it number 27 on General Orders Calendar, House File 460. Senator Limmer. Excuse me, Senator Limmer. We have committee has before it number 15 on General Orders Calendar, which is House File 1139. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you. I move that when this committee do arise, House File number 1139 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another motion. I move that the amendment made to House File number 1139 by the Committee on Rules and Administration in the report adopted May 10th, 2011, pursuant to Rule 45, be stricken. And that's just to put the exact House language before us.
On the motion of Senator Vanderveer to be stricken, all those in favor?
Mr. President.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vanderveer, could you explain, is that purely technical changes, or what did the House do to the bill? Why are we accepting their language?
Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, yeah, they are technical. It was a reference to some part of statute that was added in rules, I believe. And I'm not sure what, it's just a reference, so it would be technical purely.
No further discussion on the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1139 gives local units of government additional flexibility when they're moving to acquire used specialty equipment such as and public safety equipment such as ambulances or fire trucks, expensive equipment. When they're purchasing it used, they don't have multiple sources typically to choose from, so this allows them to bid from a single source and negotiate for the purchase of that equipment in the case when it is used and it is only available from a single source. The second thing it does is it allows the purchases of used equipment to be financed or leased for up to 15 years. Currently it's 10 years. So it just gives more flexibility in the area of used equipment for specialty purposes.
Any further discussion on House File 1139? There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Vanderveer that House File 1139 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The committee has before it number 27 on General Orders Calendar, House File 460. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when this committee do arise, House File number 460 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 460 is an issue regarding sprinkler systems in residential homes. Members, you may not know this, but the 2012 International Residential Building Code is something that we follow in the state of Minnesota. It's a well-thought-out residential building code, but nevertheless, there's an issue that in this code for 2012, the code recommends and requires sprinkler systems in every residential home to be built after that date. In anticipation of that, our state decided to create a 2010 Residential Fire Sprinkler Task Force. And those that are participatory in the building trades got together, and as they began to discuss this, it appears as though the Sprinkler Task Force is kind of going in the direction of requiring a costly addition of fire sprinklers in every home. This bill represents an opposition to what could be a very expensive mandate in the requirement of fire sprinklers in all residential homes. And it is represented that way. This bill would prohibit that, and I'm open for any discussion.
Any discussion on House File 460? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, though, I do have an amendment, the A4 amendment.
Senator Limmer offers the A4 amendment. Secretary will read the amendment.
Senator Limmer moves to amend House File 460 as filed as page 1 after line 15. Insert, this is the A4 amendment.
On the amendment, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A4 amendment is to hopefully address some of the concerns. There are some people that kind of think that sprinklers should be in a home. Quite often when we when people contract to build a home, nobody talks about this as an option. And so this particular amendment, the A4 amendment, would require on purchase agreements for new home construction that this issue is addressed and that the buyer can consider and be reminded that there is an opportunity to put a sprinkler system in their home, and if they wish, they can negotiate whatever they want with the contractor. Hopefully that this will alleviate any concern that we don't want to ignore this issue either.
Any discussion on the A4 amendment? Senator Rest.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, on the bill, but not on the amendment.
Any further discussion? Senator Howell.
Mr. President, I would rise in support of this amendment. I think it's good sense that when people are discussing building a new home that they do discuss fire protection and the availability of sprinkler protection in their home.
Any further discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to offer just a word of caution as we consider this bill. I'm sorry, are you still on the amendment? I'll hold my comments for the final bill, sorry.
Thank you. All those in favor of the Limmer A4 amendment signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. Amendment prevails. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to point out to the members that this bill is opposed by the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Labor and Industry for circumventing the process. It's opposed by the Minnesota State Fire Departments Association, by the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, by the Fire Marshal Association of Minnesota, and by the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, among others.
Further discussion, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair and members, a couple of other concerns. This bill would override any local jurisdiction with regard to sprinkler codes as well. So no city or county would be able to adopt any code specific to residential sprinklers. Another concern has to do with the process, members. This bill would preempt the rulemaking process. And the rulemaking process is typically the place where the public has a much more extensive opportunity to weigh in on the appropriateness of the proposed legislation. It would take another 18 months anyway before you'd have any mandate. So the rulemaking process could take its course. It can take all the public input. The The rulemakers would be able to evaluate all of that, the professional and technical input, and aggregate that data and information and recommend and adopt appropriate rules. And if for some reason the legislature, after that process occurred, felt it was inappropriate or it was overreaching or too costly or whatever, at that point we could weigh a legislative response to address it. But if we do a legislative response right now, we completely short-circuit the rulemaking process. And there's a reason why we delegated these kinds of decisions to the departments, the executive agencies, to go through the rulemaking process. It's because they're highly technical evaluations about what's effective, what isn't effective for preventing deaths and for construction codes, what's necessary for safety issues, what isn't necessary. What are the costs involved? For example, a recent study pegged the cost at about $1.61 per sprinklered foot, per sprinklered square foot. So it's a comparatively small cost. Sure, with the amendment, an individual buyer would be able to evaluate that. But we all know that most individual buyers aren't going to be in the position to make a well-considered and informed judgment about whether sprinklers would add the enough measure of safety, because we as people tend to minimize risk. We tend to minimize the likelihood that we're going to become victims of a harm, a fire in our home, for example. It also would short-circuit the ability for all the parties that are interested to come to some kind of agreed-upon consensus or compromise position. For example, in the rulemaking process, the parties could all agree that it's appropriate to mandate a sprinkler in the kitchen where many fires occur, but perhaps not mandate sprinklers throughout the rest of the home, like in the bathroom, for example. So those kinds of nuances are very difficult for us to evaluate in the legislative process, just as they were for us to digest in the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee when we heard an hour and a half or 2 hours of testimony on this highly technical question. The only other thing I will add is that, we have a lot of safety features in new construction, newly constructed homes. But one thing that is a consequence of the new construction, the materials that are used, is that fires tend to spread much more rapidly than they did in older homes because of the style of construction, the material that are used. What's called the flashover happens in minutes now in homes rather than in an hour or 2 hours. And frankly, it happens before, meaning the entire structure gets consumed so fast that people often don't have a chance to get out before the firefighters even get to respond to the fire. So these are the kind of concerns that would be appropriate for the rulemaking process to consider. And I offer those cautions before you decide whether or not to vote for the bill.
Senator Jungbauer. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Having built houses for 25 years and my grandfather being a carpenter and teaching me all that, I've been around the process for many years, more than that. I do rise in support of this, and it starts, members, by the fact that no building code and no fire code is visible to you. These are made by policymakers behind closed doors. There is no public input, and then they adopt it and jam it down your throat, and even then you don't have access to that code. So when you get cited for a code violation, you can't go find out what that code violation even means. These are copyrighted books that you must go buy to even understand what's going on. So that's part of the problem. The second part of it is, guess what, members? If, in fact, sprinklers cost what we were told in committee they cost, people would be foolish not to buy them for their houses. Every consumer has the option to pick and choose what they want in their house. And that's a consumer choice. We don't need to mandate everything to them. As far as fires that do happen in your house, when those fires do flash through rather rapidly, guess what, members? There's codes to put those fire blocks in every house today, and the building inspectors do not enforce those codes that actually protect that fire from spreading, whether it's in floor trusses or roof trusses or out in your eaves and overhangs. There are fire sheetrock codes that need to go in the house. But you know what? When we have our building inspectors out there, they have a unique thing in Minnesota. It's called vicarious immunity. So if they don't inspect the house and something happens to somebody because of that fire, they're not responsible.
So here we have it. I'm having a little hard time with when somebody argues in favor of some codes is we adopt codes behind the scene, no public input. It's code officials that are adopting them, and then those code officials bear no responsibility for anything in terms of enforcing those codes. Members, we have an issue here. This is an issue where consumers need maybe some more education, but they can pick and choose. But don't start letting people, and the next code issues do have sprinklers written into them. And I'm sure that nobody in this chamber knows what's written in those codes because, again, they're not visible. You don't have access to them. You don't even know they're in force until somebody jams them down your throat and adopts them. So, members, this is a great bill. We as consumers need to start fighting back and saying, no, don't mandate to us. Just tell us what's available and let us pick and choose. And, oh, by the way, inspectors, you ought to know the code and you ought to enforce it because that's the part of the consumer issue that we're not getting. We're not getting any liability on those building inspectors that don't even know what they're doing when they're inspecting.
Further discussion on House File 460, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I agree with a couple of things that Senator Youngbauer said, and that is that the fire codes should be more readily available for people to understand. I do disagree with him on a couple of things. People shouldn't anymore be able to pick and choose. They don't understand what the dangers are if they don't have a sprinkler system. And the biggest danger is the firefighters, as well as the people. I mean, if people say no, they don't want it, well, that's all fine and dandy, but then the firefighters go in there, and they're much more at risk. The chemical structure in new homes, too, is very different and very dangerous when burning, besides the fact that they do burn faster. According to all the firefighters that we had come and talk in committee, they burn faster and more dangerous for everybody in the household. So I would like to ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair, and ask people to please think about this. With as many fire departments and fire chiefs and so forth as we have that are against this bill, there's a reason for that. They're not trying to make more money off of it. They're trying to save firefighters and people's lives. Thank you.
Roll call has been requested. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I find it interesting that many times the same folks who advocate for these kinds of mandates are the ones that are concerned about affordable housing. And I can tell you right now that the price of houses going up 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 10% as a result, in part, of regulation and requirements within homes won't prevent those millionaires that, for many of you, have a bad reputation in this chamber, won't keep them from getting a home, won't keep them from being able to afford a home. But when we build layer after layer after layer of requirements into homes, it is the very people that we many times purport to help, and that's those who have the lower levels of income and are buying the least expensive homes, that we drive them out of the market. So we have to consider that these sprinkler systems and various other things don't get put in for free. There's a cost attached to it. That cost gets passed on to the consumer, and many of those consumers can't afford it. And I would submit to you that lower middle class people and others down in that range are much better off to be in their own home of some kind that perhaps doesn't have every accoutrement, every safety protection that maybe ideally we would like, than to be in no home at all.
Further discussion, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. It is kind of funny to listen to somebody say that a new house burns faster when the old houses, we never had fire blocking in the walls. We never had fireproof sheetrock. We never had carpeting that had chemicals on it that's fire retardant. We never had steel studs. We never had cement walls. We can build houses that don't burn. We can make a house literally take a 300-mile-an-hour wind. It's funny, when people come in there, they're not asking for those things. What they're asking for is it's the industry that profits. Let me say this again. It is the industry that profits from the product that comes in there and lobbies for the product to become a mandate. Because after all, members, we know every time government mandates something, we are mandating work for some group of people.
Any further discussion? Senator Kielash.
Mr. President, Senator Jungbauer has just argued that we could put codes together that would build fireproof homes and stuff, At the same time, he's arguing that we shouldn't have codes that help improve that. The idea that a homeowner knows what's in the building codes and can research it and understand it all is, why would they bother? That's why you have an expert. That's why you pay a surgeon to do your surgery, not so that you know how to do it yourself or understand all of the intricacies of it. Building codes are there to protect consumers. They are there to protect, fire codes are there to protect not just the people in the buildings, but also the firefighters that are coming in to save it. Now, to suggest that all these inspectors are ignoring their mandates to do safety inspections on everything from fire blocking to whatever is a little bit of an exaggeration, to say the least, Senator Jungbauer. To Senator Thompson's point that this that new technology shouldn't be incorporated in the codes to make these residences safer, cheaper to operate, et cetera, is like turning your back on technology. Yeah, we could build houses like we used to for next to nothing. The problem is the reason we put in building codes is they were sometimes fire traps, sometimes they fell down, sometimes they leaked a tremendous amount of energy. In fact, more often than not, we're improving the codes to improve our whole housing stock. We're not doing it just to impose costs on people. You know, having a house that's better built that will last longer is a good consumer protection. So this argument that somehow inspectors aren't doing their jobs, that new technology, new developments in housing is somehow bad for consumers is just an awful mistake in judgment.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President and members. Please be reminded that this consumers can put a sprinkler system in their home right now if they would like to. If they have a valid concern about fire safety in their own home, they can put it in now. But you know what? If they put one in, you know, they're going to have to give up probably another bathroom. They're going to have to give up the granite countertops. They'd probably have to give up a hot tub, jacuzzi, or an upgraded shower or bathroom. They would have to give up upgraded hardware, maybe upgraded appliances, carpet, other things that people choose to buy. People choose to put amenities in their homes rather than put in fire sprinkler systems because they absolutely can put one in their home right now if they want to. So please, if you're being approached on this issue by someone that supports us and you're being lobbied about this issue, please, next time, ask that person if they have a residential sprinkler system in their own home. Because most of the time, and more than likely, that answer is going to be no. And they're choosing themselves not to put a sprinkler system in their own home and put some other upgrade, some other amenity in their home that they value more than a residential sprinkler system. Because you can put one in right now if you'd like.
Senator Jungbauer.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Kielash, maybe you should read some of the fire reports, because I do. And many of them are caused by code violations. So before we answer those kind of things, and you ought to check the ones that the fire departments have had problems with. They don't have the fire blocking put in correctly. So they're not inspected correctly. So you need to study what goes on there. And let me remind you in terms of code issues and all this technology, what caused the mold problem in our homes in Minnesota? It wasn't the builders. It wasn't the way they built the houses. It was a code that mandated things that the code officials had no clue what the repercussions were. Yes, sometimes, just sometimes, maybe 10% of the time, it was something that somebody did wrong. And I've seen those too, roof flashings or something done wrong. That still can cause the problem. But somewhere above 80% was a code that sounded great. That was great new technology, and it caused our citizens a lot of problems, and that's what you need to look at. You need to understand, and oh, by the way, when you put in sprinklers, they're going to have condensation. You're going to have new kinds of mold problems with that, and sprinklers have been around. This isn't new technology. They've been around forever. People could have picked them forever to have them in their homes. Since we started inventing pipe, we've had sprinkler systems.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hate to interrupt all of this robust discussion, kind of surprised that this takes more discussion than tort reform did just a few minutes ago. But nevertheless, I just wanted to add just a few comments before we close the discussion. There are groups that actually support this: the Minnesota Builders Association, Minnesota Housing Partnership, Manufacturing Housing Association, the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and there was an earlier comment about the Department of Labor and Industry. I want to correct the record. They're not on record opposing this legislation. Thank you for the discussion, and we'll stand for vote.
There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Limmer that House File 460 be recommended to pass. A roll call was requested and is granted. Secretary, take the roll. All senators having voted. Secretary will close the roll. Being there's 41 yeas and 19 nays, the motion prevails. The committee has before it number 83 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1083. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 1083 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd also like to thank you, Senator Perry, for being a co-author on this legislation. This bill simply clarifies the definition of a public impound lot in the statutory chapter dealing with abandoned motor vehicles. It is supported by the Minnesota Professional Towing Association, Legal Aid, the League of Minnesota Cities, and both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I would ask for members' support.
Any further discussion on Senate File 1083? There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Sparks that Senate File 1083 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The committee has before it number 87 on the general orders calendar, House File 361, Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, House File number 361 be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Harrington.
This file is called a fleeing police officer. It's a modification to this. It is a short correction to an old bill. It stems from a case in Minneapolis where a Minneapolis Park police officer was killed after a pursuit. It would allow that in the cases where a police pursuit starts and the suspects flee on foot, that death to an officer or to another individual would be prosecuted, unlike today when it is simply a misdemeanor.
Taken away. Further discussion you're looking for, Senator Harrington?
No, I'd ask for it to move forward and be passed.
Any further discussion?
Sticking here.
There being no further discussion, the question occurs on the motion of Senator Harrington that House File 361 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Koch. Senator Koch, we're completed with the items on the general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee do now arise and report.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Mr. President. Mr. President.
Senator Koch.
I've moved that the report of the committee of the whole as kept by the secretary be now adopted.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Koch. We'll revert to the fifth order of business. Senator Koch.
I would move that the committee reports printed in the addendum be adopted.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Senator Koch. We're on the sixth order of business. Second reading of Senate bills that are printed on the addendum. Senator Koch. Second reading. Ready?
Senator Koch. We've completed? We will move to the 13th order of business, announcements of Senate interest. Without objection, the following members will be excused for today. Senator Han, Senator Saxog, Senator Sharon, Senator Thomasoni, and Senator Senjum all day. Senator Scheid is excused from 10 to 10:35. Senator Brown is excused from 11:45 till the end of session. And Senator Pappas is excused from 11:40 to 2:15. Without objection, they are excused. Further announcements of Senate interest, Senator Harrington.
Madam President, this week is National Police Week. It was designated in 1962 by Congress, and May 15th is designated as the National Police Memorial Day. Since the founding of our state, 222 police officers in the state of Minnesota have paid the ultimate sacrifice. 31 of those were St. Paul police officers, the most recent being Jerry Vick, who died on May 6, 2005, and in this last year, in 2010, Maplewood Sergeant Joe Bergeron and Deputy Sheriff Chris Dewey both paid the ultimate sacrifice. Tomorrow evening at 7:30 on the Capitol grounds, there will be the annual Police Memorial Candlelight Vigil that I would invite and ask all members to try and attend. It is a moment of reflection and support for all those officers who go out every day risking their lives, and a recognition for their families and their friends that their ultimate sacrifice is not and shall not be forgotten.
Thank you, Senator. Further announcements, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise along with Senator Harrington to recognize the police officers that were killed in the line of duty today. On your desk, you'll have a list of that, and I'm sure you've had a chance to see it. Senator Harrington and myself signed the document. Actually, this was a program where I actually spoke a couple weeks ago, as I have in the past, for the Law Enforcement Memorial Association. Members, again, there's going to be recognition out on the lawn if you happen to be here tomorrow. Certainly, it's a wonderful thing over here at the Thin Blue Line Memorial over here. And with that, Madam President, I would ask at this time that everybody stand and recognize the in honor of these law enforcement officers and their families who have given the ultimate sacrifice for a moment of silence.
Senator Ingebrigtsen has asked for a moment of silence. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Further announcements of Senate interest. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. I just want to announce to members and make you aware that this is a weekend for a conference called Demand Change, and it is the first time that members of Breaking Free and MATU are working together to educate people about the issue of sex trafficking. And it is an issue that is really prevalent in, unfortunately, our country and countries throughout the world. And so they have a conference now to bring awareness to this, and there's a walk and a rally by MATU, which is Men Against Sex Trafficking, and they're coming to the Capitol and having a rally between 3 and 7 today. So I just wanted members to be aware that this conference is going on about the issue of human trafficking. Thank you.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Roebling yield?
Senator Roebling will yield. Senator Cohen.
Madam President, Senator Roebling, just a quick question. I know that you're working hard and finishing the conference committee process. I'm wondering when and if not why the target figures have not been made available. We'd like to have some sense of what the comparison is and wondering when we might be able to get those.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Senator Cohen, for the question. I believe almost all of the conference reports are posted now. I think there's only two that are not, and they will be up this weekend. And so they should be coming with spreadsheets and that sort of thing, too, and that will all be very apparent on there where we're at.
Senator Cohen.
Madam President, Senator Roebling, thank you. And we're trying to do that. I'm not sure how apparent it is. If we're having trouble picking up from the spreadsheets, is there any problem with releasing those figures and just releasing what target was established for each conference committee?
Senator Koch.
And Madam President, Senator Cohen, maybe I'll take a shot at this. They're all being posted online. They're all publicly available. If you need some help with those numbers, please come talk to myself or Senator Roebling. We can help you sort through those. But they're all very publicly online, and we're working with the governor on those.
Further announcements, Senator Bach.
Madam President, would Senator Koch yield for a question?
Senator Koch will yield. Senator Bach.
Madam President, Senator Koch, I think kind of based on what Senator Cohen said, I think what would be helpful is if we knew if there was a kind of a master spreadsheet that was posted that would maybe show us all of the budget bills and what the numbers are so people wouldn't have to go to every posting and do the math themselves. Is there some kind of a master spreadsheet with all of the bills, the totals on it? I think that would be helpful if we don't have that.
Senator Koch.
Well, thank you, Madam President, and I'll certainly take the minority leader's suggestion into consideration and look back on what the majority has done in the past and take that into consideration as well.
Further announcements? Senator Koch.
With that then, Madam President, members, I would move that we adjourn until Monday. I almost said tomorrow. Sorry, members. Monday, May 16th at 10:30 a.m.
Senator Koch moves. We adjourn until Monday, May 16th at 10:30 a.m. All in favor, say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. We are adjourned.